From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, I'll be talking to a private investigator who looks for lost, missing, and stolen pets. I'm looking forward to that. Here's what's happening in Baghdad. The top commander of the U.S. forces in the Middle East says he believes the Iranians or their proxies may orchestrate an attack at any moment. He says, I think the threat is imminent, said Marine General Frankie McKenzie, an exclusive interview with NBC News. He says, we continue to evaluate our force posture in the region. The U.S. has beefed up its military presence in the region in an effort to deter Iran and protect American forces and allies. Standing on a sun-drenched bluff above the Normandy beaches where 10,000 soldiers sacrificed themselves to a savage fusillade of gunfire and opened the way for Europe's liberation in 1944, President Donald Trump has declared, we are gathered here on freedom's altar. 75 years after the D-Day invasion, the president, who has called into question America's allies around the world, including those whom Americans fought alongside in Normandy, pledged fidelity to friendships forged in the heat of battle, tested in the trials of war, and proven in the blessings of peace. At the end of the program tonight, a dramatic prayer from 1944. You've got to listen to it. You'll be very proud. One might think that the rigorous training and expectation to maintain good health would mean active Army soldiers have healthier hearts than the average citizen, right? But a shocking new study released by the American Heart Association reveals just the opposite. In the first study of its kind to compare cardiovascular health between Army personnel and civilians, researchers discovered that civilians were in better standing across all age groups. Why? Let's check in with researcher Christian Wild, author of Hidden Causes of Heart Attack and Stroke. Christian, why is this the case?
Well, it's interesting, George, that the four at-risk categories they used in the study for cardiovascular disease included tobacco, blood pressure, weight, and cholesterol. Wonder why they didn't test for stress and markers of inflammation, which might have altered the study outcome, particularly when it was determined more than 20 years ago that there is much more to cardiovascular disease than cholesterol. Because the study did not explain why the civilian population fared better than the military, I think it's fair to speculate. How much stress is someone in the military experiencing day by day?
Oh, I would say 10 times more than what the average civilian goes
through.
Good
point, George. Yes, their lives are put on hold, missing their wives, their children, and with the news almost every day, like you just mentioned, indicating the reality that they may be sent into combat at any time to any hot spot in the world, Iran, Korea, or whatever. Just suggesting, had the additional markers been included in the final analysis, would there have been a different, perhaps more accurate result? Because the study did not come with any conclusions.
Kristen's website, myheartbook.com, has a lot of great information about keeping your heart ticking along, so go to it.
Wouldn't it be nice?
Brian Wilson has postponed his upcoming tour, citing unforeseen health issues. In a statement, the 76-year-old singer revealed that his performance at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in New Jersey next week, along with the remainder of his tour in June, has now been put off for now. So we wish Brian Wilson the best. Prayers to him. The guy's a genius. Your phone company may start blocking robocalls without needing to ask for it. I would hope so. The Federal Communications today passed a ruling that allows and encourages phone companies to block robocalls by default. Robocalls are a rising nuisance in the U.S., and many of them are illegal scams. The call-blocking company UMail estimates that there are some 4.7 billion robocalls placed in the U.S. just in May alone. I think I got about 2 billion of those calls myself. My gosh. As I reported yesterday, Amazon says it plans to use self-piloted drones to deliver packages to shoppers' homes in the coming months. The online shopping giant did not give exact timing or say where the drones will be making deliveries. Amazon said its new drones will use computer vision and machine learning to detect and avoid people or clotheslines in backyards when landing. I thought we'd bring in our expert on these matters, Lauren Weinstein. Lauren, how in the heck is this going to work? I mean, where's the drone going to originate from, for crying out loud?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because the range of these things is quite limited, so you end up having to have deployment points scattered around within, you know, a certain number of miles or wherever they're going to go. Plus, their weight-carrying ability is very, very limited. you're not going to carry a big box on these things. As you said, they're being very hazy about the details, and I think there's a good reason for that. When you really start to think about this, you realize that there are severe limitations on how you could ever make this work. If you're in a rural area and you're carrying something light, like maybe some medical equipment or, you know, medical pharmaceuticals or something, this is what they've mostly tested with so far, and especially if it's rural, so that if something goes wrong and you crash, you have a fair chance not hitting anything that's going to get hurt. Now, imagine trying to do this in an urban area or in a suburban area. Everywhere you fly, you're going to be flying over houses, people, pets, cars, streets, everywhere. And when these things go wrong, when they have mechanical failures,
and they will,
or if someone takes a pot shot at them, and they will.
Yes.
A wind gust at the wrong time can take them down. There's all kinds of ways that they can fail, and, you know, mechanical failure is going to happen by a certain percentage.
Oh, sure.
They're just going to go down, and you're going to crash into roofs, you're going to crash into solar panels, you're going to crash into cars and into windshields. Worse of all, you could crash into people. You could crash into children and pets who would probably have been attracted by watching the thing coming down near their house in the first place, right? They're going to come running. Oh, look at that. Boom, and down it goes. And then you have the little problem of how are you actually going to get the packages down? Are you going to land the unit completely? What if the person's in an apartment building? What are you going to do? You're going to land it in front? You're going to land it on the roof? What happens when you get down to the ground and the kids in the neighborhood come along and say, hey, this is something fun to throw a brick at?
And the thing's spinning around and everything.
No, they're going to be pulling pieces off of it, or they're going to reach their hands in.
And get their fingers cut off.
You can't shield the propellers completely. And if you try to do this in a backyard or something, you risk hitting an animal or landing, you fall into the pool. Yes, there are situations where you can use advanced systems, computer learning systems, all these things, to avoid certain classes of problems. But you're still going to get bird strikes. You're still going to get mechanical failures.
Yeah.
And if you're in a highly populated area, you stand a really good chance of causing serious damage or injury.
I think so, too. Plus, you know, some of the packages may fall off prematurely. Who knows what will happen?
Yeah, you really want that collection of books landing on your roof or on your windshield.
This is where technology, Lauren, I think, is going way too far.
Well, I think what will happen is it seems, you know, as I said, there's situations where this can work, and especially if you're in rural areas where you have, you know, you're trying to routinely get, for example, something between two hospitals or something in an emergency, you can see how to do this. But the prospect, we're sort of sold the idea that, oh, there's going to be thousands of these buzzing around, and you just go to your computer and make a quick order with Amazon, and an hour later a drone is dropping books on your doorstep. I don't think that's going to happen for most of us who live in heavily populated areas or even suburban areas.
No, I don't think so. And give me your quick take on the FCC trying to stop robocalls.
Yeah, well, this is a lot less than it sounds like, because this is basically just says that the carriers now have permission to block them by default. The thing is, they don't really have a way to block them by default. The technical means to do that doesn't really exist beyond the ability to block calls where someone has tried to falsify the caller ID. The means to do that are being deployed. But if somebody is using legitimate numbers to make robocalls, and that's what's going to happen, it'll all migrate to that to the extent it hasn't already, then you need whole different ways to determine when it's a robocall. And in general, that doesn't really exist yet.
Good point. Lauren, we'll talk to you next Tuesday with two special hours you'll be on.
Yes, looking forward to that. See you then.
Lauren Weinstein, our expert on all these matters of technology. Up next, we're going to talk about the fourth turning in American prophecy, what the cycles of history tell us about America's next rendezvous with destiny. And welcome back to Coast. Neil Howe with us. He is with the Hedge Eye Risk Management Firm, an independent financial research firm. He is a renowned authority on generations and social change in America, an acclaimed best-selling author and speaker. His latest book is called The Fourth Turning. He is the nation's leading thinker on today's generations, who they are, what motivates them, how they shape America's future. He's currently also a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and the Global Aging Institute in Washington, D.C. Neil, welcome back. I'm looking forward to this discussion with you tonight.
George, it's great to be here again.
You know, so many things keep changing. My granddaughter, who's a millennial, is informed me I'm going to be a great grandfather. And so, what would they call her baby?
Well, we haven't gotten to naming them yet, but it'll definitely be the next generation. I mean, there've been some there've been some suggestions out there. Generation Z is popular, and the Pew Research Institute is pushing it. You know, we've had a name out there for a while, the Homeland Generation. To talk about kind of post millennials, these would be kids today. Oh, by our reckoning, sort of out to the beginning of middle school or somewhere in middle school today. But you know, another 20 odd years passes, a generation is gone by, and millennials are, you know, their front edge is hitting, beginning to hit age 37 now. So, you know, this process never ends, George.
No, it never does. You coined the phrase millennial generation. That got picked up by a lot of people, didn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of become ubiquitous, hasn't it?
It sure has.
I've been blamed. I've been called names by everyone because of that. And interestingly, you know, with the visibility now of millennials, particularly in politics, you know, with AOC and what's going on, particularly on the left, there's almost this conversation now between boomers and millennials that sort of leaves Generation X out. You know, so Gen Xers are always sort of the onlookers.
Yeah, you know, that's right.
Just kind of lurking and kind of glad to stay out of the argument. But it is interesting to me that we actually, you know, among the rhythms we point out, there's an alternating rhythm between what we call active and recessive generations. You know, active generations come of age at a time of a social moment, you know, when something really big is happening historically. So, for example, the GI generation came of age with, you know, the Great Depression, the New Deal, the World War II, a lot was going on. And, of course, they became this very heroic Promethean generation, the greatest generation, all that. The next generation got a lot less press, right? This was the silent generation.
Mm-hmm.
They came of age during the American High, the presidencies of Truman and Eisenhower and John Kennedy, and they're silent. I think that kind of says it all, right? They kept their heads down. They didn't make any noise during the McCarthy era. They all wanted to get jobs and merge seamlessly, you know, into the establishment, into the suburbs. So, and then boomers came along, right? Another active generation. And then Xers came along. We'd call them a recessive generation. And now millennials, they're making more noise. And we've long had a prediction that this generation would be eventually become politically a very dominant generation. And that still could happen because it's still pretty early, you know, pretty early in their life history. We wouldn't have seen much about, you know, where the GI generation was going to go in the mid-1930s either, right?
That's true. Neil, do these generations, though, dictate marketing techniques, products to build and buy, and things like that, too?
Well, they inevitably do, because if you're a marketer, you want to understand better how people, you know, think. You want to understand what their, you know, emotional touchstones are, kind of how their, what their values are like. And I think particularly it helps to predict where an age bracket is going, because every age bracket, you know, you think about, you know, people in their 30s, right, or people in their 40s. Well, over time, that age bracket is vacated by a generation and then occupied by a new generation. So understanding kind of the generational transition that's occurring in that age bracket is really critical to being able to design, you know, to be able to look ahead. I go into firms all the time, you know, they may be selling cosmetics to people age 40. And I ask, how do you know, what people, you know, women age 40 are going to be buying, you know, 10 years from now? They say, we know everything about 40-year-olds. You know, we've studied the whole history of that phase of life. And I say, you know, so we know, right, what 40-year-olds are going to be like. We extrapolate that forward. And I said, that's funny. I said, what I want to know about what 40-year-olds would be buying, you know, 10 years from now, I look at today's 30-year-old. You know,
that's right.
The same people, right? And so, but it's amazing that people don't do that. I call this actually tracking the generational diagonal, following the same people over time. And marketers generally don't do that. And so this is, you know, the art of doing that is something I sometimes teach.
Neil, what is the title, of course, The Fourth Turning? What does it mean?
Well, The Fourth Turning is an idea that's been around now for a while. I mean, that book, you know, that's a couple decades old, right? And it refers to an idea that we developed, Bill Strauss and I, in our first book called Generations, came out, in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that generations throughout not only the history of America, but nearly all modern societies, generations are not only different from each other, but that they arrive in a certain kind of pattern. Certain kinds of generations always follow other kinds of generations, and that pattern is actually linked to certain recurring rhythms in history itself. So the sequence or rhythm of generations gives rise to a rhythm of history, and we see that rhythm of history, we're seeing it today. You know, we look back, we have a tremendous, you just ask public opinion polls, tremendous amount of foreboding about the era we're entering. We see the rise of populism and authoritarianism around the world. Everyone wonders what the hell is going to happen in the 2020 election. We don't even know if we can stand another recession. Interest rates are already so low. We've got inverting yields. So, you know, the clock is already ticking on the next recession, right? And so we're thinking, wow, this is really a terrible time we live in. Let's look back 80 or 90 years about the length of a long human life. And, you know, where were we? Well, we were in the 1930s, right?
That's right.
We were in the Great Depression and the World War II era. And you go back another long human lifetime, you're back in the Civil War, right? Another long human lifetime, mm-hmm. you're back in the American Revolution. You see where I'm going?
Yeah.
You go back again, you're in the War of Spanish Succession.
It wasn't all rosy back then, that's
well,
for sure.
But not only that, but these things occurred in a certain rhythm. That's my point.
There's a pattern to this.
And that roughly halfway in between these great civic events that kind of reshaped our outer world of institutions, politics, empire, the economy, roughly halfway in between those, we had our great awakenings, right? We had our great, the times in which we rediscovered our inner world. We reformed religion, values, literature, culture, music. And the most recent one of those we had back in the late 60s and 70s. And in fact, historians give those names, you know, the first great awakening, the second great awakening. We name them, we number them. Some people call the 60s and 70s America's fourth or fifth great awakening, depending on, you know, you want to start with the first one back in the 1630s with John Winthrop, or start it in the 1740s with Jonathan Edwards, right? So my point is that history has a rhythm, and this rhythm is shaped by generations, because generations are shaped young by history, but then they go on as midlife leaders and parents to shape history. So you see there's a complete circle here.
What creates the parallels, Neil? I mean, it's not a coincidence.
Well, the timing, and, you know, people talk sometimes about rhythms of history, but then you ask them, what times the cycle? You know, you think history has a cycle, right? Well, what governs the timing?
Right.
Well, in my case, it's easy to explain. It's the human life, right? We're formed in our youth by our experiences, and then later on when we actually shape the events and the institutions, there's a certain discrete time that goes by. I mean, it's between the time you come of age and the time you're maybe of senior leadership age, maybe that's 40, 45 years. So there is a kind of a master clock here.
Hold on for a second, Neil. We're going to hit a break. We'll come back and talk more. Ironically, today's the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Another cycle, perhaps? Later on tonight, we're going to be talking with a private investigator who looks for missing pets. Very interesting indeed. And welcome back to Coast, Neil Howe with us. We'll take calls with Neil next hour here on Coast to Coast. Neil, what was it that got you interested in what we will call generational history?
Well, just seeing what generations have done. You know, I grew up with boomers. And I saw what their generation has done. started out with such promise. Now boomers are getting blamed for everything.
Yeah.
But totally aside from the blame, it has always fascinated me how different generations can look at life so differently. You know, we now see millennials who are so you know, from the perspective of older Xers and boomers, just behave differently. You know, they're generally they're risk averse. They're really seeking these very sort of structured, sheltered environments. And we see that in the workplace. We see that even in politics. And we're seeing the kinds of behavior and outlooks on life, which sometimes makes us think this is less like us or less like what we're becoming than maybe something we would have associated with our parents. You know, Igor Stravinsky used to say that every generation declares war on its parents and makes friends with its grandparents.
Yeah.
And I do see that.
Yeah,
I mean,
he's right.
We see that, for instance, the fourth generation actually is generally very, very similar to each other, right? So the generation that raised your parents is generally very similar to the generation that you have become.
That's where we get along with the grandparents sometimes more than the parents.
Exactly. Yeah. So. And so we see a lot of these, and it also explains why, and these are generally the parents of our parents are generally the ones who are sort of fading from memory. And it's also why, in terms of cyclicality, the sort of natural cycle that we see, the cycle we're entering, because the whole cycle takes 80 or 90 years, is generally the cycle just beyond the living memory, right? No one mm-hmm. really remembers what the world was like the last time we were here, right? So we're always entering a kind of a mood or a set of challenges that no one today alive can no any longer remember, right? And that's why this last decade, which has had so many similarities to the 1930s, you know, it was in the wake of this tremendous financial crisis, these new problems of growing inequality between rich and poor, the dissolution of unions, the problems with productivity and living standards, and then the whole issue of what's happening around the world, right? The rise of these authoritarian regimes, sort of populism and all of this stuff. And we weren't here. The great power alliances were all breaking up. You remember back then it was the League of Nations. Today it's, you know, NATO and UN.
Mm-hmm,
and,
that's right.
And in other words, you begin to see back in the 30s, everyone was living together with their parents. They were doing it in these big Victorian homes. You remember back in all those Frank Capra movies like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, families, well, they're doing it again today.
It's a right? wonderful life.
Yeah. Well, today they do it in McMansions. You know, it's boomers living with their millennial adult kids. But my point is that the last time we were here, no one really remembers it anymore. You know, you'd have to go out and actually ask one of those D-Day veterans, and there are not many left anymore.
What is it about the music, for example, for the generations that continues to change as well? Because, you know, my dad was the GI generation. His music was different from my mother's, which was in the silent.
Yeah.
And then the boomers, mine, it was way different. And then my kids, the Xers, their music favors were different. And then my granddaughters and my grandsons, they're millennials, they're different. Why does the music change so much for those different generations?
Music is an early indicator of generational change because the music is such an intense focus of people in their teens. It really is. In other words, you look at a lot of other things. You look at movies. You look at TV shows and so on. Much broader. You know, there's kind of a much broader distribution by age, but the age bracket for pop music is very narrow, and that's why the musical trends is just so clear. I mean, that's kind of your early warning sign for looking at the appearance of new generations.
You're right.
We've seen that. And we've seen that continuously. But the point is, yes, we've seen, you know, we saw, you know, ragtime and blues with the missionary generation, then came along the lost generation. It was jazz, which is a dangerous music. I mean, jazz was a word for sex, and it was the whole rise of the Harlem Renaissance. You also had this enormous migration of African Americans, just hugely enlivened, you know, the culture in the North during the 1920s,
mm-hmm.
and gave rise to this crazy wild mix, put the roar into the Roaring Twenties, really, and it became popular throughout much of America. That was kind of the wildness of the lost generation. Then you had the GI generation take all that jazz and homogenize it and make it much more collegial and upbeat, and that became the big band sound. That became the swing bands. Do you remember that?
Oh yeah, and they're gone.
That was more orchestrated, bigger scale, more kind of upbeat, kind of more wholesome. And the GIs did that actually with a lot of lost generation trends, made them more wholesome, cleaner, sort of, you know, what we finally remember, boomers remember with kind of distaste back in the 1950s, kind of saccharine, sweet, you know, completely mm-hmm. homogenized culture. And of course, boomers came with music that appalled and horrified their parents. So much so that when the GI generation finally retired, the first members of them started retiring in the mid-1960s, their idea of retirement was a community in the middle of the desert, you know, with names like Leisure World and Sun City, so they could get away from their kids. And these original communities had age-restricted covenants, so young people could not move anywhere near so that they could listen to their Benny Goodman in peace and not have these horrible, you know, rock music,
the Beatles,
kids that they never liked, and they knew these kids hated everything they had spent their lifetime building, right? So anyway, that was a big generation gap, and remember, that's when everyone started talking about the great generation gap, and that was a very serious thing because a lot of those fissures between boomers and their you know, greatest generation parents never healed.
Well, and also clothes styles and things like that changed for the generations dramatically.
Yeah.
Hairdos, everything.
But particularly we forget that in that era, the 60s and 70s, particularly late 60s, 70s, how extreme and how controversial and how upsetting those differences were. But you're right. The differences themselves continuously exist. I mean, today they're not upsetting. I mean, you look at millennials and no one gets upset how they dressed. You know, they may wear flip-flops to work or something because no one told them the rules about flip-flops. And if someone had told them the rules, they'd say, oh, gee, sorry, I'll do the right thing next time. Boomers were different. Boomers wanted to provoke, right? Boomers wanted to transgress. They really wanted to.
Right. Now, the millennials seem like they want to fit in.
They do.
Yeah.
They want to fit in. And the biggest problem I see in workplaces with, you know, older people grousing about them is that the older people have never really told them what the rules are. They just assume the kids ought to know what they are. it's very difficult for millennials to figure out things like dress codes because, of course, boomers and Xers have no dress codes, right? So how are these young people supposed to know how to dress? So the young people are actually, and there's an interesting thing about millennials, they're constantly looking for standards. They're looking for conventions. But their parents and older people refuse to give them a convention, so it creates a kind of a weird, an awkwardness that was much the opposite of what boomers faced. you know, boomers in the late 60s, they knew what conventions were. You know, their parents had all kinds of conventions.
Sure.
How to dress, how to talk, and boomers didn't want to follow them. And here you have these millennials, you know, keep asking older generations, you know, gee, what's expected of me? And they didn't never get an answer.
What about, Neil, technology? Technology, does that help change some of these generations as well, or do the generations change the technology?
That's a great question, and your last comment was absolutely perfect, because that's what I tell people all the time. People are constantly asking me, how does technology shape a generation? You know, it's like the mobile phone comes along, or the internet comes along, and it just shapes everyone, right? So it's this random exogenous thing that just sort of happens, and then we're all kind of randomly shaped. We're just passive recipients of technology. I don't believe that's true. I believe the causation is reverse in exactly what you just said. It's not that generations technology shapes generations. Generations shape technology. Mm-hmm. A great example of that was back in the 1980s. You remember Reagan used to say the microchip was going to bring down dictators everywhere in the world. And then President Clinton and Al Gore used to say the same thing. The internet was going to bring down dictators, you know, and then Tiananmen Square, oh my God, we know that's the first, you know, it's the death knell for any authoritarians. And well, look what's happened.
Yep.
No, the authoritarians just learned how to reverse all that technology and use it to police people and actually have an even harder, you know, iron fist on their populations. And now they can truly control everything, because now with these monitoring technologies and this face recognition, in every city, for example, in China, what they call the social credit system, people are graded on everything.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So here's my point. Technology follows the social mood. The technology is not shaped the social mood. The technology reflects it. And that's an important part of how I look at how this whole system works.
You call the generation Xers 13ers, not Xers. How come?
Well, I did back in the beginning, but, you know, after Doug Kuplan's book. I mean, the funny story is that in our original book, yeah, we called them 13ers, but the generation after them we called millennials. And, of course, that name caught on, and, you know, that's what everyone uses now. And, you know, advertising age a year later came out with this term called Generation Y. And that was popular for about 10 years. And then finally, you know, Ad Age kind of threw in the towel and they said, okay, well, I guess, you know, Howe is right. And just, you know, they grumbled. And we had, I think, back at the office, a little bit of champagne and kind of congratulated ourselves. But here's the interesting thing. Doug Kuplan wrote his book, his novel, Generation X, about a year and a half or 2 years after we did Generations. And that book gave the name to Gen X, right? I mean, you know, that was Gen X. And Doug Kuplan was born in 1961, which I would regard as kind of the first birth cohort of Generation X. And he wrote that book. But the irony then is, George, is that, and I tell this to Xers all the time to make them feel even, you know, worse about their lives than they already do. And that is that the generation that came after them got its name before they did. I mean, imagine that, right?
Yeah.
So millennials got their name in 1991 when they were still kids, you know, still little kids. And Xers had to wait until later when they were practically in their mid-30s. So, again, you remember I talked earlier about active and recessive generations. That's a sign of being in a recessive generation, right, when you don't even get a name until much later than everyone else.
During the Vietnam War, the boomers were the ones who protested. They did some things right. They did some things wrong. The things they did right, protest is fine, as far as I'm concerned, as long as nobody gets hurt. But they attacked our troops, and they never should have done that. I mean, I remember troops coming back from Vietnam were booed in the streets, and
yeah,
it was ludicrous. But I don't recall the Xers or the millennials getting involved that way in a political way. Or am I wrong?
No. I mean, with boomers, it was personal. And there was a lot of screaming and hatred. It was like that show we used to watch back then. Do you remember All in the Family?
Oh, yeah.
All in the Family.
I remember it well. It was
every show.
It was groundbreaking. It
was just, you know, Meathead and Glory, I can't remember her name, but just screaming at each other. Everyone was screaming the entire program. And that was kind of what, you know, if you want to explain to millennials what the late 60s and 70s are like, it's just everyone screaming at each other. And one of the reasons boomers scream so much at their parents was their parents were just unflappable. You know, they had everything under control. They were always optimistic. The system is going to work. We've got, you know, Vietnam. Yeah, we got it taken care of. You know, it's pest control. You know, whatever it is, the economy. We, you know, you could not get a rise out of that generation. So millennials, you know, boomers had to practically blow sticks of dynamite to get them to respond. Anyway, that created a very unique environment. But no. Millennials are personally very respectful. You know, they're more of a thank you for your service generation than an actual service generation.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that only a small minority of millennials actually serve. Of course, we now live in a professional army where the requirements to serve are much higher than they were back when, you know, the boomers had the draft.
But I don't see them upset about the war in Iraq, we're still in Afghanistan. They just seem to accept that.
Players, and they are excellent, excellent troops. You know, everyone, all of the Xers I talk to, you know, all the colonels, all the generals, they used to be boomers, now increasingly even the generals are Xers, they have nothing but great things to say about these kids.
Yeah.
They
dedicated.
They follow orders, they excel, they bring all of their skills to bear. And it's useful to remember too, you know, people complain now about millennials because they're all into socialism and all this. You know, this is kind of the AOC phenomenon, and you know, it's true. I mean, a lot of millennials don't think the American capitalist system is working for them. It certainly is doing nothing for their living standards, doing nothing but, you know, piling on debt and you know, giving away market power to some of these huge corporate behemoths that have all this pricing power. But here's my point is that.
Hold the point. We're going to take a break. We'll come back at the top of the hour. We'll talk more about the millennials and what's going to happen to them. And we'll take phone calls with you, Neil. Neil Howe, his books, of course, The Fourth Timing, Generations as well. We'll be back in a moment with your calls on Coast to Coast AM.